You're listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza right here on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and each week I will bring you guests that will inspire, educate, and in some cases entertain, while bringing answers and options to raising children today and in our constantly changing future. I will address issues such as locating a runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and so much more. Now, having over 30 years' experience working with families in crisis, I've been fortunate to meet and work with some of the top professionals in many of the helping fields and authors that share valuable stories and helpful information who are all working to keep your family mentally, physically, and spiritually sound and make this world a better place for all of us. And I'll continue to bring you some of these incredibly talented and caring people each week as we bring you Answers for the Family. Now, our topic today is home drug testing, and it's more than just detecting adolescent drug abuse. It's a stepping stone onto that road to recovery. Now, to talk about this and more, I'm happy to have as our guest today Tim Chapman. Tim is an internationally recognized addictions counselor whose 3 decades of experience include living, learning, teaching about, and treating the problem of addiction. His studies and credentials include a master's and doctorate degree in metaphysics, certified alcohol and drug abuse counselor, and level 2 certified clinical supervisor, to name just a few. Tim is a sought-after speaker and has extensive experience on radio and television. His newest book, Middle Essence, Handling the 26-Year-Old Teenager, is also now available in paperback. Now, Tim has designed 6 hospital-based treatment programs for addiction, as well as numerous outpatient clinics in the United States and abroad. He created the 6 Basic Feelings Theory, which is utilized in his adult and adolescent residential treatment programs. Presently, Tim is the executive director of Teen Savers, a program for adolescents suffering from substance abuse, emotional, and behavioral problems. Tim, welcome to Answers for the Family.
Thank you, Alan. I'm really happy to be here this morning.
Well, I'm glad to have you. As many of the listeners know, I interact with a lot of the families. I'm talking to a lot of the parents, and one of the things that I wanted to touch on pretty quickly is, when I'm out there and I'm talking to parents, they've called me to locate the runaway teen, and right. And they'll answer my question about drug use as no. And it's one of the questions we ask every family. So tell me what the problems are. And, has there been any illegal drug use? And many of the parents will say no. And I'll ask them, well, okay, but tell me, how can you be so sure? How do you know? And I'm thinking when they say no, it means that they've been drug testing it. But it's amazing how many times their answer will be, well, because, when I was young, I smoked marijuana, so I know what marijuana smells like, and I know what alcohol smells like, so I know they're not on drugs. So share with our audience why this isn't effective.
Very interesting thought, Alan. Yes, I encounter the exact same situation when parents bring their kids into my office and we do an evaluation, and many times you, in fact, have admitted several kids into our facility as a result of going out and doing interventions, and they'll come in with the same story. I've had parents come in and say, well, I don't think he's drinking or using, but we haven't tested him. Why not? Well, because exactly what you just mentioned. Dad drinks socially. We're pretty good role models. We don't think there's a problem. They're not stealing our booze and things of that nature. So they just assume it's okay, but unfortunately, 80% of the kids that are coming in are using drugs and have been, and they could be A students, and they could be honor students, and they could be athletes, and they could be from the best schools or some of the more troubled schools. It really doesn't matter. It's an equal opportunity issue when it comes to teenagers. And so parents, I think, mostly are in denial or uninformed because of their own history and the shame that's still attached to drug use, that I have some sort of responsibility for it. See, if we have a kid who comes in, he has depression, and we deal with depression, we diagnose him with you know, like a major depression. That somehow is acceptable to the parent as opposed to, well, he's using methamphetamine. And the reason that's acceptable is because it's not my fault. Depression has nothing to do with me watching my kid or watching over my kid. At least that's their perception. So that's the kind of answers I get as well. And it's sad, but that's what's happening.
Well, and now you just mentioned depression. Now, you know, oftentimes when they come in and they're diagnosed with depression, is there still a drug issue that's maybe a secondary issue because they're using it to try to mask the depression?
Absolutely. Or to self-medicate.
Yeah.
Yes. Many kids will use alcohol to self-medicate their depression. And as you know, and maybe probably most of your listeners who are pretty well-versed after listening to you for a while realize alcohol is a depressant. And it certainly doesn't help depression. It compounds the problems associated with depression. So, yes, kids mask it, and kids try to treat themselves unknowingly. I mean, we look back, and I've been at this 35 years, and I look at, for instance, kids coming in 30 years ago. It was pretty much marijuana and alcohol.
Right.
And there was heroin. And it's interesting, it's gone through the gamut, the cocaine, the methamphetamine, and these days we're back to marijuana, alcohol, and opiates for the most part that I see kids coming into treatment. And parents are much more likely to be using some sort of pain reliever or medication themselves than they were 30 years ago. That's my opinion based on my interviews with kids coming in the program and parents.
Well, now, and that really takes me to two points, but I'll start with the first one, which has to do with marijuana. And you mentioned about 30 years ago, and I think for anybody that may have experimented with it 30 plus years ago, explain why it's so different. You know, that the marijuana of 30 or 35 years ago versus the marijuana of today, share with us what the biggest differences are.
Well, one of them is the attitude, a national attitude, is that it's more of a harmless substance, more harmless than, that certainly is the attitude of most adolescents I speak with and parents, that it's no longer this. I mean, we've got guys that were sent to prison for life for selling, you know, pounds of marijuana, and today it's practically legal.
Right.
So there's a whole different attitude about marijuana, that it's not as dangerous as alcohol, which, you know, there's a good argument there. But at the same time, because it has become so acceptable, it has now become, quote, safe in parents' minds. And they think, well, it used to be, well, every kid's going to drink a little alcohol going through school and going through college. That's just normal. Now it's, well, every kid smokes some pot. Whereas 30 years ago, that was not the case. It was, well, maybe we did it, but the parents were not going to tolerate that, let's say 10, 15, 20 years back. Today, it's more tolerable. Kids that are 18 can get medical marijuana cards. They share it with their younger friends. There is such accessibility, as you know, Alan, on the Internet, that you can buy drugs over the Internet. And I'm sure you have experts that you've spoken with on this topic, that kids can get on the Internet and buy just about any drug there is. But marijuana is seen, for the most part, as pretty benign. That's one of the major differences today and yesterday. Kids that come in today and say, well, I'm not going to stop smoking pot. I'll stop opiates and I'll stop methamphetamine and I'll stop drinking, but marijuana, I'm not going to do that. And 30 years ago, that would have been a primary drug we targeted as to create abstinence. So It's a whole different attitude about that.
Exactly. Now, and as you're talking about opiates, and you mentioned about, you know, a lot of the parents are on some form of painkiller or some form of antidepressant themselves. How is that affecting the mind of the teenager?
Well, as you are well aware, kids are like a bird on the perch sitting at the top of the room, hovering over the living room, and they see and hear everything that's going on, whether mom or dad believe it, they know it. And they're taking it in, and they're like video cameras, and they're taking information in, and they're internalizing it. And they're watching what mom and dad say, don't say, do, and don't do. And they're internalizing that, and that equates into their attitude. And so they're watching this, taking in, so whether mom and dad say it's a bad thing to be taking drugs, yet they run to the medicine cabinet, and they're taking OxyContin for their chronic back pain or whatever it happens to be, every kid knows what is going on. They see
right.
it. They see the difference in the mood. They see how it affects their parents. So it just becomes kind of like, if you can do it, I can do it.
Right, so, yeah. Yeah, I was going to say, and it affects their credibility. You know, now the credibility of the parent that's saying no you know, is diminished based on the fact that they're going, well, actually, I've been stealing it from you, you know.
So different story today.
Yeah, really. And I know that you know, for a lot of the parents, and you mentioned, you know, there's a sense of denial. You know, why is the home drug testing important? And explain how they can do this. And it's not like the old days where they had to think about, okay, you know, I have to take my child to my doctor, and then the doctor's going to know, and who is he going to tell? You know, explain how simple, really, the home drug testing is and how important it is for them to have it in their family.
Well, I think the most important point, Alan, is that, frankly, you think I had that home drug testing kit in my home for my child. I think it's more important for the parent, because the parent is the one that's in denial, and the parent is the one that needs the information. Kids already got it. Kids already know they're using, and their goal is to, you know, get around mom and dad and hide. And so what it does is it allows it gives the parents a tool to test their kid. And again, we get back down to those interviews where you go out and see the family and they deny drug use, or they come in and see me. They deny drug use with a home test kit right there. You can't deny it. And with the home drug test kit, the Teen Savers home drug test kit, the big significant difference in that one and any other kit you can pick off a shelf in Rite Aid, let's say, is that we have a guide in there, a guide that parents can pull out and read prior to doing anything, prior to approaching their kid. As a matter of fact, tells you how to approach your kid. Why am I approaching my kid with this? Because I think parents might buy this thing and set it aside and never use it. But if I know why I'm using it and how to use it, and I've got some kind of support behind me, I'm more likely to use it. So first of all, it's important for the parents. It's important for kids to know that their parents are on it, so that they show them that I'm responsible. A responsible parent. And I know most kids will say, no, you know, my friends and parents don't test their kids. They trust their kids. And that argument can be made that, well, I trust you as well. I just don't trust the world anymore. There's too many things out there. There's too many things that can happen without you. There's things that happen to me that I had no idea could possibly happen to me, that I thought I was totally geared up for, and it didn't work for me. And I'm just trying to give you something else to protect yourself. So if you are abstinent and you are not using drugs, then this is a great tool for you to maintain that abstinence and tell your friends, you know, I can't do this because my parents have a drug test waiting to take it as soon as I get home. So give the kid an out with his friends.
That's right.
That's one thing, and it also gives the parents the support. And I'm, in particular, again, and I am the spokesperson for the Teen Savers Home Drug Test Kit. It's not my product. I just represent it because it's a superior product because of you can do a 12-panel test, a 9-panel test, a 6, a 5, a 1, whatever you want. Every one of those tests have laboratory confirmation results, if you like, that confirms the results. So if you think, gee, mom and dad, this isn't correct, great. We just put it in the bag that's supplied with the kit, send it off to the lab. They will confirm what's there. And the other thing is, with the parental guide that I wrote to help parents guide them through the process prior to testing their kids, it really is helpful for them. And then they can call the 800 number if they have more questions and say, I read this about how to approach my kid. What do I do next? So, see, basically, this one has a system that allows the kids and allows the parents together to look at this thing and say, well, let's do this together and just follow this. If everything's great, great. All you need to do is apologize if it's a negative. I'm sorry. Well, you know, yeah. I'm sorry. I'm worried about you, and I did that. But if it's positive, then you take the next step. But, you know, I'd rather take an apology than be speaking to a mortician.
Right. I couldn't agree more. And when you bring that up, it makes me think that, you know, one of the things is that and why I love the parental support guide is, you know, if it comes out again, you can rejoice with them that, you know, that it came up negative and make sure that they know that it was done out of love. You know, this is something it's because I love you so much that I want you to do this, you know, and you know, you may be angry with me, but it's because I love you so much that I'm willing to accept the fact that you may be angry with me, because, you know, it's more important, as you said, you know, than to have to, you know, go see you at the morgue. So
right. Well, yeah. For instance, Alan, in the parental catalog that goes in this test kit, one of the questions is, if my child is angry and resistant about taking a drug test, could that be a sign that I have overstepped my boundaries? And the answer really is possibly. But remember, you didn't just wake up this morning and tell yourself, I think I'll drug test my kid today for no reason at all. Chances are you have several pieces of data or evidence in your mind as to what you think, why you think you should be doing this. So you're not just waking up one morning saying, I better do this just to be sure. By the time you go to Rite Aid or wherever on the internet to get the drug test kit, you've probably got 5 to 10 things you can write down, specific things that have motivated you to even have this thought.
Yeah, and let me share with everybody out there, for those of you that are seated at a computer, you know, you can go to the website. You can follow along with us right now. You can go to myteensavers.com, and you can see, you know, you can see exactly what it is that we're talking about. Now, obviously, if you're out there driving, don't be trying this. But but yes, I mean, you can go to the site. You can take a look, and you can see the difference. I mean, you can see that. And you can also order from there as well. I mean, you can order from there if you'd like. And again, that kind of goes to the, you know, the parent that may feel a little bit of shame. And I'm not suggesting that that's what you should, because I don't think right. that. But, you know, that still doesn't mean that there aren't some people that do. And if you don't want to go to a Rite Aid or a Walgreens or something like that, again, you can just go to this website. You can order it from there. You know, it gets sent to you. It's something that if you feel like you need to keep this within your family, it's set up as a way to do that as well.
And perhaps we can address that shame later in the show, Alan, because I really don't think it is shame. I think it's fear. Shame has a whole different connotation to it. And as I explain about emotions, as we've put it together through our programs, I'll be able to define that more clearly.
I think that would be great. I would love that. So, and actually, I don't see why we can't really kind of talk about that a little bit right now.
Okay.
You know, because I know, and I mentioned in the introduction that you were the creator of the six basic feelings theory, and this is something that I know that's being used in your programs where we have brought young people. But share with the audience a little bit in regards to what the six basic feelings theory is.
Okay, the six basic feelings theory is really the art of feeling, and it really is an art. And it's been developed. I created it over 30 years based on research, based on working with thousands of families, based on my own stints in rehab 7 times. I mean, I've heard it all. I've gone to programs that are educational in nature, and so you go in and they hand you a book and say, okay, let's go through this exercise and read this book and then get it. Kids don't get it out of a book when it comes to this kind of stuff. You can't think your way out of something you felt your way into. And that's what's happened with addiction is people get emotionally attached. It becomes a relationship, and you don't just think your way out of it. You have to feel your way through it and then out of it. And how do you do that? You experience the feeling, first of all. So how do you experience it? Well, first you should identify it. And that's why we came up with 6 basic feelings, which we believe are the foundational feelings or foundational feelings behind all emotion, if you will. For instance, anger. It could encompass irritation. I feel bad. I feel anxious. That could also be fear. But if you get my drift, that anger is like the anchor emotion. And all other words that I use to describe that really come down to that foundational feeling. So anger is our emotional response to not liking and not agreeing with something. And that anger is actually a healthy emotion. What happens are people feel anger, and then they act out with their anger, and they behave in a way that gets them in trouble. So they say, see, what I need anger management because I have a problem with anger. Well, no, you don't. You have a problem with your behavior. There's no problem with anger. Anger is healthy, normal, and natural response to something. I'll give you an example. You're driving down the freeway, and you're going to be late for a meeting, but you think you could probably make it. So you're breaking the speed limit. You're doing 70 instead of 65. All of a sudden, your brakes slam on. There's a traffic jam. How do you feel? And people will say, well, you choose to feel that. I don't know about you, but if I'm in a traffic jam and I'm late for a meeting, I feel angry, and I didn't choose it. It is an emotion that automatically, it was an autonomic response that came up as a result of the situation I'm in. Okay, the question is, what do I do with it? Do I give the international sign? Do I lean on my horn? Or do I take a breath, turn up my radio, and relax and wait for the traffic to start moving? I have a choice in how I behave. Uh-huh. But the anger is the anger is the anger. And so feelings are not feelings are like cats that come and go as they please. You don't control them. You control your reaction to them. So I am in control of my actions and what I say and do about it, but I'm actually not in control of the automatic response to that emotion. I'm going to feel mad when I feel mad. I mean, I can set myself up and put myself in situations where I end up angry, of course, and I know better than to do that. But when I do it, I'm going to experience that feeling. So I'll just first, if we have time, I'll just say the 6 feelings, and then we'll go from there. There's mad, sad, glad, afraid, ashamed, hurt. Those are the basic feelings. They are all okay. They are all healthy, but they can all become dangerous, unhealthy. They can undermine you based upon what you do with them, don't do with them, say how you present them or don't present them. If I sit in my anger for 10 years and don't tell anybody how I feel, and you tap on my shoulder and call me a name, you may get 10 years of my anger in your face at that moment. That's called unresolved resentment and projection. And so many people say, well, stay away from that guy. He's really angry. Well, we're all really angry. But the difference is, Alan, you may deal with your anger as it comes up in most cases, so you don't carry resentments, whereas someone else may be what we call more passive with it, and so they don't like to express emotions at all, so they just kind of bury it and bury it and bury it and bury it and carry it and carry it and carry it, and the next thing you know, boom, they're a time bomb. That's not necessarily means anger is bad. It means anger has not been expressed. It's been repressed.
Well, let me share one with you, because as you said that, it reminded me of something. Now, this is something that I do, and I had somebody else in the car with me that kind of pointed out what I do. But just as you were talking about the situation with the freeway, it became a high anxiety situation.
Yeah.
And somebody came over and came within inches of hitting me. You know, and I swerved really quick, and I was very angry about it and stuff like this. And I turned to the car, you know, and I looked to try to make eye contact with the person, and I said, "I am so sorry." And then I started driving, and the person in the car with me said, "Why did you do that? That SO blah blah blah, you know, yep. just did this," and they were like this. And I said, "I've come up with a new way to approach it. I look at it from the standpoint that there's only a certain amount of intelligence. There's universal intelligence that we all pull from. And I assume that I must have pulled more than my share at that moment and must have taken his because he reacted in a stupid way." And she started cracking up. And I said, "You know, I found that keeps me from carrying that stress through the rest of that traffic jam."
You know? Absolutely. You debrief your feeling, and it goes away. And when we work with kids in treatment, that's exactly what we do. We'll say, okay, kid will come into me, for instance, he'll say, you know, he's used his anger against his parents. So it's not an anger, it's his behavior. He'll slam his door, he'll run away, he'll call them names, he'll steal. That is anger, unresolved, acting out. And so what happens is parents fear his anger. So they walk around, you know, on eggshells around the kid. And by the time they bring him in, he sits there and he's in one corner and mom and dad are in the other. And they go, "We can't talk to him. He's so angry." And I go, "Well, that's okay. We'll just bring him in. We'll deal with it." He goes, "Screw you." And he'll start calling me names and things like that. And I'll say, "You know, you sound angry to me." He says, "I am." I say, "Okay, that's good. I want you to come on in. I want you to be as angry as possible and bring that anger with you because I just love anger." And the guy looks at me like, "Is this guy nuts? Something wrong with this guy?" And they're like, "Wait a minute. This guy just short-circuited my game here that allows me to control my parents because I threaten them with our anger outbursts and things like that. And this guy's inviting it." So something interesting happens at that point because I pattern interrupt them. Their pattern is to control people around them with anger outbursts and threats and so on and so forth, whereas I'm not emotionally attached to them, so I invite it, and it's like, what's going on here? So I actually become safe now because I'm not reacting to it, because every time the kid gets the parents to jump through hoops with their anger, the child feels out of control as well. Because there's no adult in control. If I can control my mom and dad, who's in control of me? Nobody. So I'm feeling out of control. So what happens is when they bring him in, and I look him in the eye and say, "Love it. Bring that anger. Love that anger." And they're like, "This guy needs psychiatric care." That's what the kid's thinking. And so I just disrupted their pattern. And so they're interested in, one, can I play with this guy, or how am I going to beat this guy? And two, maybe he can help me because he's not buying into this thing. Right. I think that's what happens when you allow the kid to come out with that, and you don't engage in the game they've been playing with their parents for years.
Yeah, and Tim, and you know the additional beauty to that is, because I know what you're saying is you're doing a pattern interrupt, but you're also, as I see it, taking away that button that they keep going to, that becomes that go-to button with their parents, and they keep going to that, and all of a sudden it's like you've hidden the button. Going to that now doesn't work, or at least it doesn't work with you, and you've taken it away, and now he has to change his focus. So it's a beautiful way to approach it. But you know what? I'm getting a notation here. We need to take a break. We are going to be right back. Please, everybody stay with us, because not only are we going to continue with the six basic feelings, but we're going to be talking a little bit more about home drug testing, and we have some instant messages coming in from people. I'm going to ask those questions of Tim, so stay with us. We'll be right back.
Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, Westshield specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you.
And we're back. You're listening to Answers for the Family. Our guest today is Tim Chapman, and we are talking about Teen Savers. One of the issues that we're talking about are home drug tests, but Tim is also the executive director of Teen Savers, which is a program for adolescents. And within that program, one of the theories that they work with is the six basic feelings. So stay with us. We're going to be talking about those two subjects. But I also want to address, we have an instant message coming in. This is for Tim. This one says, our PTA has been discussing how we are going to organize a workshop on helping parents identify and deal with drugs by their teens. Does Teen Savers have literature for associations that would help guide us in this effort?
Yes, we do, and we can actually come out and help you if you'd like.
Okay.
No charge.
And can I give them...
You put on the seminar, help you put on the seminar, and do lots of things that will... You might as well use the expertise if you can get it, and we'll do it for you.
And I really appreciate that. Now, is it best for them, do you have a phone number that they should call, or is it best to go to a particular website?
Why don't you email me direct, Alan, that I get it direct, or have them email me direct at interventiontim. Well, that's the adult. Tim@teensavers.com.
Okay, so that's tim@teensavers.com.
Yes.
Okay. And please, so direct that. You have not only the answers to your question, but it sounds like you have somebody that will come out and help you set it up with the family as well.
Right. Every district has a different kind of a sense to them, and they're a different culture. And so they kind of describe the culture, and we kind of work with that and what's going to work best for them.
All right. And we've got an email that has come in. This one reads, our 16-year-old son started a new part-time job last month. It says, not knowing about some of their procedures, he was chosen to take a random drug test. He was upset when he came home, telling us that for the first time he was smoking pot, which was about 2 months ago, with his friends. He went ahead and took the test. Thankfully, the test came back negative. Although we are not happy campers, we do not want him smoking marijuana. I was so happy to see this topic on Alan's show, as your test seems like a perfect option. We just wanted to comment that we are buying several of the kits this week for our own random testing. So
great.
That's nice.
And congratulations that your son, first of all, shared that with you, and that you do have the test kit, and that's great.
Yeah, I thought the same thing just as I was reading it, and I was thinking, you know, it was nice that their son came to them first and said, you know, I have to go in tomorrow or whatever for this test. Now, that does bring up really another question, and this one came in, which I think will probably work well following that one. This one says, how long does marijuana stay in the average person's system?
Well, that's a great question. I get that question all the time. And Alan, I'm not sure what your experience is, because I know you have a lot of experience in this area as well. But mine is, it really depends on the quality or strength of the marijuana, for one. Could be hash-based. There's so many different strains, as they call them out there, strengths, different types of marijuana, that it's really hard to tell. I mean, in general, if I'm a kid who went to a party and I smoked a joint for the first time and somebody passed it, and I went home and said, Mom and Dad, you know, this is the first time, and here I am, I did this, And that's what usually you'll get with kids who really are afraid, really have boundaries, really have trust with their parents. It happens, and they will tell them generally before there's a suspicion. And they'll say, Mom, Dad, I did this. I apologize. Then that's a great time parents get to sit down and say, thank you very much for being honest. We really appreciate you doing this. Now we can work together and we trust each other. And here's what you can do next time. But unfortunately, most kids get caught on a drug test or something, and then they say, oh, I just tried it yesterday. And that's usually not the case. By the time parents catch kids using, my experience is they've been using 2 years at minimum. Uh-huh. And they say, well, no, he just started a couple months ago with what he told me. 2 years. And I'll take a $100 bill out in every meeting and lay it on the table and tell the parents in front of the kid, $100. He's been using 2 years. I'll bring him in here. I'll ask him. I'll go $100 he's been using 2 years. And I'll win every time. Now, that's because it's of our experience of working with kids that get caught. Now, trying to get back to the question, I'm sorry, about the strength and how long is in your system. So if I'm the guy who went to the concert and somebody passed a joint and they smoked it, you should be test clean in three days. If I'm smoking marijuana 1 to 3 days a week, it might take a couple of weeks or so to test clean. Now, I'm saying clean on a test, meaning no nanograms. It doesn't pick up the marijuana. That doesn't mean it's completely out of your system, however. It could still be in your system for months. But is it detectable? No, generally not. That's my experience. So if I'm a chronic user, I'm using every day or I'm using 4 times a week, it's going to take a month get a clean test, and in this day and age, maybe even longer, based on the strain of marijuana that's being used or the combination of strains of marijuana that's being used. But what you can do to mitigate that is you get the test, and then you send it to the lab, and it gives you a quantitative level. That means it tests for the drug, and it actually tells you that the amount of nanograms that are in their system. You test them again next week, and if it's going down and it's less, you're going in the right direction. If it's going up, you're going in the wrong direction, and they're still using. That's how I would handle that.
Yeah, I think that's a great answer because, yes, you're right. I have been asked that question before, and I've answered very similarly to the point of it depends on how long they've been smoking. It depends on the strain that they've been smoking. And it also depends on their metabolism because
some of us,
everything runs through our metabolism faster than others. So you're right. It's such a wide spectrum. Usually if we have to give some form of a guess, you know, a middle ground, and middle ground has usually been like 21 to 28 days to be safe.
Yeah.
So,
exactly.
So anyway, and again, thank you everybody for those questions. If you didn't get a chance to write down Tim's email, you can always go to our site, answers4thefamilyblog.com. We'll have all the information in regards to how to get a hold of Tim, either through the Teen Savers home drug testing kit or through the website for his rehab programs. Now, let's go back. We've got about 10 minutes. And let's go through and kind of get everybody through the 6 basic feelings. And I think you said that they were what? Mad, sad, glad, ashamed.
Afraid, ashamed, and hurt. So I'll just go through them quickly, Alan, because I can spend 3 hours on this in workshops and processing. But just the Reader's Digest version is this. So if we look at – we have these, by the way, in huge charts on our walls and our treatment rooms and things. Mad, sad, glad, afraid, ashamed, hurt. If you're in my office, you're sitting there, and it's right there. So I ask how you're feeling. You say, well, I feel like it's going to rain today. Well, if you're a ball player, you might be mad. If you're a farmer, you might be glad. Uh-huh. So you're not describing a feeling. You're describing a thought. I think it's going to rain today, therefore. That's where communication gets mixed. That's why the 6 basic feelings is so important because it helps decipher feelings, thoughts, behavior. We separate those 3 things, and it's magically we're communicating with our kids. So Let me go through them. Anger is our emotional response to not liking and not agreeing with something. Normal, natural, God-given. Sadness is our emotional response to loss. Whether I lost a relative, I lost my pet, I lost my wallet, I missed the bus, I didn't make it to the game, there is loss there. And with loss comes a grieving process. Now, you're obviously, if you lose your uncle, you're not going to grieve as you would if you missed the bus, obviously, unless you didn't like your uncle.
Right.
It's real possible. But the point being is we experience this feeling at different levels, but nevertheless we experience sadness. So you can call it a little bit sad or whatever you want to call it, but if we just embrace the feeling that we are feeling sad regardless of the intensity, sadness is okay. It's a process that allows us to let go of the stress inside. Glad. Most people see glad as the goal, happiness. Glad is, oh, yeah, I'm elated. I'm happy. Well, I see glad as balance. Glad is being who I am, understanding myself, having these emotions, being able to handle them, and just having like a homeostasis in my relationships. That's glad. That's living in glad. Now, is that a goal? No. That just happens to be a process because we feel all these emotions, most of them anyway, every day, all day. Every day. Uh-huh. And so it's an ongoing process that we're not aware of. It's only, we're only aware of it when we have a huge, you know, interruption, like that traffic jam. Then we're very aware of our anger. But otherwise, we're not really totally aware of it. So just being aware that it's okay to be mad, it's okay to be sad. As a matter of fact, I should be sad when I have a loss. It gives me permission to have sadness, and when I have that sadness, I let it go. If I don't express it, I keep it, and then I carry it, and that turns to resentment, unresolved emotion. And so does glad. If I don't get a chance to share that, that eventually turns into resentment. So we got mad, sad, glad, afraid. Fear is our emotional response to the unknown, or I don't trust this. If somebody offers you a brand new Lexus for $300, your head says yes, your gut says run. Mm-hmm. Your gut says, I don't trust this deal, it sounds too good to be true. Listen to your gut. Your head is saying, yeah, but man, for $300, this is just, wow. So the point I'm making is fear keeps us safe. Fear keeps us informed. Fear lets us know that our boundaries are being somehow violated and that we need to be aware of that. Then it helps us, and when we acknowledge that, it helps us to make a better decision. Don't buy the car. The next emotion is ashamed. Shame. And there's two types of shame. There's healthy shame and there's toxic shame. Healthy shame is experienced as a mild embarrassment. Oops, I made a mistake. Uh-huh. Toxic shame is experienced as an overwhelming inadequacy. Oh my God, I am a mistake. And toxic shame is made up of generated messages that I've accrued throughout my lifetime from friends, family, mom, dad, relatives, that you're no good, you'll never amount to anything, where'd you get a stupid idea like that, it's never going to happen, you might as well forget about it, you'll never make it to college. All these negative messages that we hammer ourselves with as children, as kids, as adolescents, and then as parents. That is what we call toxic shame. So if I come up to you and say, gee, Alan, great tie. You say, oh, this whole thing? Yeah, I just picked it up at a thrift shop, you know. And you'd negate everything. I just give you a compliment. You find every way you can possibly find to negate that because you have a sense of shame about it and that there's somehow something defective about the way I chose this tie or the color of the tie. So we live our life trying to protect ourselves from being attacked by people that are trying to expose our toxic shame. And when we're in treatment, dealing with kids or even adults, toxic shame is our target. If we can start to release toxic shame, it's like cutting a wound and allowing the infection to pour out. If we can allow that to happen and get that through, you are now able to take and understand that shame is simply embarrassment. And you should be embarrassed. If I say something that is shameful to you, Alan, in a crowd, or I notice that I said something to you and I notice the feeling, I can sense your feeling that you are hurt or angered by it, my next step should be, if I'm in touch with my own healthy shame, would be to say, Alan, I apologize. I think I said something that was out of line. I don't wait for you to tell me. I tell you. And I apologize. That's a person with a healthy sense of shame. Because you feel that shame, and you take that to the person and say, you know what, I think I overstepped my boundary here, and I apologize. So healthy shame helps to keep us contained from violating other people's boundaries. Keep us in our own space. Toxic shame knows no boundaries. Toxic shame, here's one, I'll give you an example. Have you ever heard somebody besides me that go on and on and on and on, talk and talk and talk and talk and talk, and never say anything? That's a person who is continually debriefing their shame. They keep talking so you can't ask them questions, because if you ask me a question, you just may tap into my toxic shame, and I won't know what to do with it. So as long as I keep the conversation going quickly and you can't get in, I keep you away from my toxic shame. That's a prime example of someone dealing with toxic shame. So anyhow, shame itself is a healthy emotion. It keeps us contained from violating other people's boundaries. It is our social value system. I feel a sense of shame when I do something outside of my value system. I feel an embarrassment. And that tells me you better pull that in, Tim, and you better stop that behavior. Okay. And then finally, hurt. Hurt is our emotional response to being violated in a relationship. Did you know people don't get hurt by people cannot hurt you that you don't know? Only people, I'm talking on an emotional level, the only people that can really hurt you are people you're in intimate relationships with, because the relationship is valuable. And hurt is an emotion that is directly tied to trust. And so if I tell my best friend a secret, say, please don't say this because it will embarrass me. Oh, no, I'll never tell anybody. And then I walk in the restaurant, he's telling six people. Now, I might first go off in anger and want to throw a chair at him, but I don't. Instead, I leave. I feel hurt. And then the next best thing is to talk to them later and say, yesterday when I went in the restaurant, you were talking about the issue I asked you not to, and you promised not to. You violated. I feel hurt. So now, knowing the feelings, mad, sad, glad, afraid, ashamed, hurt, it's critical that I utilize those particular words when I express myself, because when you use those words, they're very powerful. Everybody knows what you mean. There's no mixed message, and that's what helps clear communication. That's why we use those words.
I love it. And I know, and we just have about 2 minutes, but I also want to make sure, let's talk a little bit about middle essence. So okay. we all know that we all go through adolescence, but you know, more and more there seems to be issues with middle essence. Tell us a little bit about the book, and why you wrote it.
Okay, that's a term I coined, middle essence, as a result of working with adolescents and parents. I've been doing this so long, Alan, that now my kids are bringing their kids to see me. And so I'm seeing more kids in the 26-year-old range. And I call them middle-essents because they never made the leap from the emotional part of adolescence into adulthood. And so many, and I describe it in the book, and the book has been retitled to The Power of Parental Influence. So you can get it under both titles. But the point of that is middle essence is where I get stuck between childhood, between adolescence and adulthood. So let's say I'm a kid and I'm 20 and I'm at home, and this is what evoked this in me. How do I get that 20-year-old Cheeto-eating, dope-smoking, Jerry Springer-watching, no-job-getting adolescent 20-year-old off my couch, out of my house, and on to get a job and get on with his life? That's what inspired me to write the book, because I saw so many of those kids. And the problem is, the parents want them to stay there for many reasons. That's in the book. Why would you want your kid to stay here? And I've got 10 reasons in the book why you would want them to stay there. to take care of your own unmet emotional intimacy needs, to keep the barrier between mom and dad, many reasons. But then there are reasons there should be 26-year-olds living at home. They're in college, they're productive, they're helping out with the family. You know, so there's reasons for kids to be home when they're in their 20s, particularly today with this financial atmosphere we're in. But the point I'm making is, the kids who are not going anywhere and they're just on the hamster wheel and they're 22 and they're living at home, they need to move on. But the problem is not them. The problem is motivating the parent, just like the drug test. When you go to the drug test and say, gee, how do I approach my kid? Read the pamphlet. It'll tell you how to do it. Read the book. It'll tell you how to approach your 22-year-old and help him leave the house, because parents many times don't want their kids to leave because they have their own unmet needs that their children happen to be meeting. And so if I can meet my own needs, I can let my kid go and get on with their life, and then everybody wins. But that's what a middle lesson is. I'm stuck there, and everybody around me is helping me stay stuck there and enabling me to stay stuck there. So that was the premise of the book, and how to get past that.
And that's a great description again for anybody that, if you, you know, I suggest if you have that situation, you know, pick up the book. You got
to
do
go to Amazon.
Yeah. Okay. Great. It's on Amazon now. Go pick up the book. You're going to have to do more than just stop buying the Cheetos. Tim, thank you so much for coming on. I'd love to have you on again. It is always a pleasure to talk to you.
Yeah.
And I will look forward to talking to you again soon. For everybody else out there, please listen to this plea. This is the season of giving, and I have a very dear friend who is going through some very difficult things. So please listen to her daughter, Darnell, and have a great week, and be with us again next week. Take care. Goodbye now.
My name is Darnell Young, and I'm desperately reaching out for help. In 1970, after a blood transfusion, my mom contracted hepatitis C, which later evolved into terminal liver cancer. A transplant is her only chance of survival, and we don't have the means to fund the surgery. My stepdad's working as much as he can, and I just got off chemotherapy myself, so I've been limited in what I can do. Any amount you could give would help our family more than you can possibly know. You can go to our fundraising website at youcaring.com. That's youcaring.com, and search One Family's Battle, onefamilies_battle, and you can donate directly there. Don't forget to capitalize the first letter of all those words. Thank you.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza, right here on LA Talk Radio.